Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. I'm Andrew Muller. On this week's episode, we're reviewing Honey, the brand new album by Swedish pop star Robin, her first in 8 years. Discussing the record and the things it reminded them of, with me today are Deputy Music Editor for The Guardian, Laura Snapes, and the journalist and broadcaster, Kate Hutchinson. Robin first appeared on radars in the mid-90s as a teenage pop star with a top 10 single, Show Me Love, but it wasn't really until a decade or so later that it became apparent that being a teenage pop star wasn't going to be nearly enough for her. Robin's eponymous LP of 2005 gave us songs like With Every Heartbeat. 2010's Body Talk featured the huge hit Dancing on My Own. And that was, give or take a few collaborations and guest appearances, Robin's last new music until now. Although such is her influence on modern pop, it seems like she's barely been away. When she announced a brand new album a couple of months back, there was a great deal of excitement and intrigue among her fans. And that is Robin now. Honey came out last Friday, and that is what we are here to talk about today. Kate and Laura, welcome to the show. I do want to start by talking about that 8-year gap. She's back at last aspect of this. This is a thing I get weirdly mesmerized by, the musician who takes a long time to make a record. It's the, what are they actually doing?
She did release quite a lot of music during that time. It just wasn't kind of Robin canon. There was an EP with Royksopp. There was an EP with this group that she formed called La Bagatelle Magique, which was her, Marcus Jägerstedt, and Christian Falk, a musician she had worked with since her teens, who died while they were in the middle of making the record. I think he had pancreatic cancer. And then she also did an EP with a Swedish or Norwegian DJ called Mr. Top Hat. And so she has been releasing stuff, but it's all been very like dancey and protracted. And it hasn't been, you know, copper bottom bangers in the same way that Body Talk was. And she also said that she did try and start working on a record of her own during that time, but she was so poleaxed by grief about losing Christian, and also her relationship broke down for 2 or 3 years, that she felt that she had nothing to say, so she wanted to wait until she really felt like she did. So she's not been twiddling her thumbs.
Well, that's good to hear. Kate, do you think much has changed between this album and what she'd been doing previously?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's subtle changes. Like Laura just mentioned, copper bottom bangers. And she's still, on this new album, she does have, you know, a few bangers, but they're more refined. They're more undone. They're a little bit more, dare I say, some of them are a bit more chill out. So I think she's just, you know, she's been experimenting with different sounds. She's been collaborating with different people. And she did a track with Kindness on his last record called Who Do You Love, which was really beautiful. And she's also done some work with Joseph Mount. And so those two are the collaborators that have popped up on her own album, which I think is really interesting.
Laura, those difficulties and traumas that you mentioned that she's endured over the last few years, are they reflected in the new record?
Yeah, massively. So when I interviewed her, she talked about how the record is basically sequenced in the order that the songs are written, more or less. So it starts with this song called Missing You, which I think started by being about losing Christian, but then it was also about losing her partner and kind of losing a sense of self as well. That awful word, journey, but the journey that she went on was like finding a way to feel good about herself again, and also to allow herself to be softer and more vulnerable in a way that she never really had before. If we talk about Body Talk and the records that came before that as well in her independent phase, she's always used these kind of very, like this very robotic imagery, and her songs have been very steely, and they've always been about kind of metabolizing heartbreak and pain and moving on as quickly as possible. You know, she's indestructible in those songs, and she realized through going through this very real trauma that she couldn't be indestructible anymore. And so you get a lot more softness and emotion and kind of teasing through individual emotions in this record, I think. You have loss, and then you have acceptance and sadness and pleading for forgiveness, and then kind of resolve at the end. So you really get to see that journey in real time.
I mean, as we've been discussing, she hasn't been idle for 8 years, but 8 years is still an absolute eternity in pop music. Kate, is it easier for her to return to the extent that she's returning after that period, because still so much of the modern pop landscape has kind of been defined by her?
I think that makes it harder, doesn't it, to then figure out how you're going to return and kind of the cut above that, you know. She's had a lot of people come through who's, you know, they've definitely been influenced by her. They've even, I think, in your piece, Laura, you talked about Lord, who'd performed with a picture of Robin framed on a piano in one television performance. So you've had people like Lord, you've had Perfume Genius, you've had Carly Rae Jepsen. There must be some others that I'm not thinking of.
Yeah, every teenager who's come out of Sweden since, like Sigrid and Alma and all of them.
Yeah, they're always compared to her. They've always got, you know, the mark of Robin, you know, because they sound slightly sad in their songs or something. So yeah, I think it must be, I can't really tell you what was going through Robin's mind, although I did interview her once skirting around the edges of this subject. But, you know, it must be hard then to sort of figure out how you're going to make something that feels authentic to you, that feels different, because every record she's done has definitely been inventive and covering new ground in a way. So I think, yeah, that is a massive part. And when one of your big collaborators who really understands you musically passes away and really suddenly, then you're kind of left with this bugger. What do I do? Where do I go from here? So, yeah, I think that's completely understandable.
Laura, on the subject of that influence, which is, you know, obviously colossal, it's always interesting, I think, when a particular artist becomes not merely popular but actually influential, why them and what it is about them. Aside from thinking not so much about the scale of her influence, which is obviously immense, what is it about her? What is it that about Robin that compels vaguely similar artists to, example, pin her picture to their keyboard?
I think you can break it down into a few things. I think that, you know, when you, her 2005 album that came out, that was her first independent one. It didn't actually come out in the UK till 2007. But when With Every Heartbeat was number one for 1 week that summer, you know, the summer that Umbrella by Rihanna ruled, it kind of marked a transition away from teen pop, like X Factor produced stuff, towards much more sonically interesting pop, which I think we're still hearing a lot of now. You know, I think one of the Robin trademarks is those kind of hammering, relentless arpeggiated chords. And then also the amount of information that she can fit into a song, like the narrative complexity, and also, you know, having sad narratives against happy sounding music. You know, that's like a disco thing, but it wasn't something that had really been part of pop for quite a long time. And then I think also the other influential thing is how she presents herself. You know, she's like a leading female pop star, but it's never been predicated on like sexy face and, you know, doing all of the things that female pop stars are expected to do. She's had mullets, she wears platform shoes, she dresses like a robot, she's had confusing aesthetics at times. It's never been what you're expected to be. And I think she has shown a completely different way of being a female pop star.
I guess that also means, though, that it makes it, she's never really had the sort of commercial success of all the other people that have come after her. And that, I suppose, you've kind of hit the nail on the head. You can't really put her in a box, in a category. She always does what you don't expect her to do. And she's always kind of going for that sort of rebellious take on things.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, a lot of her fans, you know, people have been really, really anxious for her to release new music. And the Body Talk album came out in three parts, Body Talk 1, 2 and 3. And I think a lot of people would have been really happy with Body Talk 4. And I wonder whether she probably could still have written those songs. But I think, you know, like Kate was saying, it's in her nature to be rebellious. I don't think it would have felt true to her to come out with a load more songs like Call Your Girlfriend and Dancing on My Own. She had to do something different to continue being her most Robin-iest Robin.
Just quickly, her last album opened with the track title Don't Fucking Tell Me What To Do, which really underlined it, I think.
It's not the most ambiguous statement of intent.
No.
And do we know what she thinks of the artists she has inspired? So when I've spoken to other influential artists at various points, especially off the record, you can occasionally discern a certain amount of resentment, especially, as is often the case, they've been the pioneer who has done all the work of clearing the field and has then ended up sort of abandoned and forgotten while everybody else has moved in and reaped prolific bounty.
Obviously, people are always diplomatic in interviews, but she, when I spoke to her about it, she genuinely didn't seem offended by it at all. She was even too kind of elegant to name anybody else in case she was like imposing herself on their art if they hadn't actually cited her as an influence. She mentioned Lord because she knew about the picture thing. But I don't think she's ever really worked like that. You know, when she was a teen pop star, she was basically primed to become Britney Spears, but she was like, absolutely not. And so the American record label that she turned down went and signed Britney Spears. She's basically the reason that Britney existed. She was on that treadmill for like massive influential pop success from age 16, and she didn't want it then, and I don't think she wanted it in 2005 either. She would say in interviews around then, I don't want to be Madonna. It looks horrible having to be Madonna. You have no private life. And I think that's something that's also part of her being a Swedish pop star, is in Sweden they're very unshaken by celebrity. You can live a pretty normal life. I briefly walked around Stockholm with her and nobody bothered her. You could tell people kind of clock her, but nobody came up to her. So I don't think she's ever really wanted that, and I don't think her mind works that way.
Okay, do you think that period though, or the memories of that period as a teen pop star, are still important to her? That sort of thing that's lurking there, that, you know, a process that she went through and experienced and understands and is always there as the thing she doesn't want to do and the thing she doesn't want to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think from interviews that I've read with her and pieces that I've read on her, she's had a lot of therapy to get through what must have been a very frustrating period in during your formative years. I don't think being a teenage pop star is a particularly pleasant thing for anybody.
I struggle to think of examples where it's turned people who've gone through it into well-rounded individuals in later life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that when you're a young woman trying to figure out who you are and your place in the world, and you've got some old dude in a suit, or maybe a whole group of them, you know, deciding your future for you and how much sort of leg you should show in your music video or whatever, you know, is a particularly positive place to be. So yeah, I think that's probably, you know, gonna have an effect on you. I mean, she's pretty, I mean, again, I can't speak for her, I don't know, but she seems very well-rounded. You know, she left her US label, she started her own record label, she's very much in charge of her own destiny and her look and her vibe. And I think probably that experience has contributed to her being this kind of emblem of independence and, you know, two fingers up to the man kind of gal.
Because on a related note, Laura, in that piece, that big profile of you did for The Guardian, which I do recommend to our listeners, you say that she's defined herself against the music industry's lack of imagination. But do you think is there a peculiarly 2018 version of the music industry's lack of imagination, or is it the 60-year-old struggle at this point?
The commodification of female independence, you know, goes back to like the early 90s and like, you know, record labels seeing that TLC were popular and then creating the Spice Girls and then creating things off the back of that. But, you know, the branded feminism is a huge thing. I think, you know, Caitlin Moran's book, How to Be a Girl, How to Be a Woman.
How to Be a Woman.
Whatever the first one was, yeah. I often think of that as kind of like the year zero of commodified feminism. Not that she was doing it, but that brands went, oh, this is really popular. We can market this idea to people.
Yeah, it's put on a t-shirt.
Exactly, yeah. And so I think more than ever now, the image of female independence is central to every young female pop star that comes out. We're led to believe that they're fully in control of their business, they're making all the decisions. Even if they're not writing the songs themselves, they're picking the songs. And that, you know, often may well be true, but, and maybe I'm just very cynical, but I feel deeply suspicious about that being true. Robin said, when I interviewed her, there's no such thing as freedom under a major label. Lily Allen said a similar thing recently as well. However these young women are marketed, I don't think that's the truth of how their businesses are run, and that's exactly the same as it was for Robin in, like, 1995.
I've also got something to add to this, and that is not just in terms of the kind of image and what you're presented with new pop stars, in terms of the actual sound. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that Laura has recommended this article to the future... What is it? The Return of Muzak? The Problem with Muzak.
Oh, the Liz Pelly one, yeah.
By Liz Pelly, who's a writer for Pitchfork and others in America. And she talks about how music is all sounding the same because of streaming services, because of Spotify. Pop music is becoming ever more, or music in general is becoming ever more unimaginable because people just want to hear the same sorts of sounds, and that's why you get all of the songs of the summer sounding the same. So not only have you got major labels wanting to kind of institutionalise this idea of feminism and present that back to young women, but you've also got the fact that musically things are sounding ever increasingly the same also.
We should talk about the psychoanalysis which she has been doing, which Kate mentioned earlier, which I know she talks about in your interview with her, Laura. Four times a week she was going.
Yeah.
Do we understand why? And also, I guess more importantly, is any of this manifested on the album? Because when a record comes out of a particular artist deciding to sort of explore their their inner workings intimately, that can often be a very good thing. It can often also be the other thing.
Katy Perry witness, can't it? Why it actually is, what Kate was saying, the reason that she decided to do it, or one of the primary reasons, was to deal with the effects of young fame that it had on her, about her ability to form relationships. You know, you're never on an even keel with somebody. If you meet somebody and they knew who you are and you don't know who they are. And she said that had a huge effect on her. Also, she said her parents had a very unconventional relationship. She grew up as part of their touring theatre company until she was 6 years old. Like, she was never in a fixed place. They were always touring around Sweden with this like avant-garde Russian futurist theatre company. And she said when she actually went to school, when she was six, you know, she felt like she didn't have the codes that other kids did. And then her parents broke up when she was about 11. And that's when she wrote her first song as well, which was about their divorce, which is very precocious. That's a song that she sang in a school assembly that got her spotted and then got her signed in Sweden. So, yeah, that was the reason that she got therapy. As for how it manifests in the album is called Honey, and there's this song called Honey, which first got trailed about 18 months ago, playing over the credits of an episode of Girls, and so fans have been gagging to hear the whole thing ever since. But I think she said there's been 21 different versions of this song, because it was a song that she felt that she had to get right to fully convey the experiences that she had been through, the kind of vibe, and she keeps coming back to this word, sensuality, like allowing herself to have a level of sensuality and access to her emotions that she might have closed off before. So I think Honey, even though the lyrics aren't about therapy, is very much a manifestation of that. Actually, saying that it's about therapy, I really believed what she said it was about. And then my boss said, it's about oral sex, isn't it? And I was like, oh, maybe it is. Maybe it's both. Oral sex as therapy, who knows?
Kate, did you hear any of that on the album? Did it strike you as one of those overtly ruminative albums?
Probably, but I come at it beats first. So, you know, for me, Robin has always been, you know, as much as people talk about her in the sort of grand tradition of, well, they talk about her as a redefining pop and, you know, being an iconic pop singer, and she's now kind of getting this respect almost, if you like, with the reappraisal of, you know, what she means as an artist. I've always seen her as being really wedded to the dance floor. Not that the dance floor is some kind of cage, but, you know, I DJ her tracks. I love hearing her tracks in a club. I think Girls creator Lena Dunham asked Robin to create Honey. Was it for a dance floor scene?
She asked what she had like in the bag, and gave her the vibe of it, and then she sent through some ideas.
Yeah. So for me, Robin's always been a dance floor hero, if you like. And so I just came at it beats first. So I was listening to, that's what struck me about the album, is the way that things sounded like 90s house, but weird and wonky and undone. And I love this idea of soft ecstasy that's on all the press material, because that just speaks directly to what I'm interested in, this idea of escapism, but also melancholy.
I mean, Laura, do you think, or did you get the sense talking to her as well, that there's any self-consciousness, I guess, if that's the phrase, about the position she now occupies in pop, that this will be seen to an extent as something like the monarch returning?
I can't remember if I spoke to her about that. She said that she didn't feel competitive. She said she used to have this killer instinct, which you can hear all over the Body Talk records. Like Kate said, don't fucking tell me what to do. There are so many songs on those three EPs, that album, about like her standards and how like the schmucks around her don't live up to them. But she said that just completely subsided. You know, I guess it's one of those, it's that classic thing. When you lose people, you suddenly realise what's important. And I think that kind of competitive pop streak, if it had been there, kind of disappeared from her. So I know that she understood how much people wanted her back, and she kind of found it like a bit daunting and thrilling. Like, she kind of didn't believe that it was really true. I don't think it's something she pays too much attention to. And I guess that's kind of what makes her good. You know, she's not playing to the crowd.
I mean, there's also that thing, I guess, not, and it's not just in music, it's in most walks of life, that often, not always, but often, people, ambitious people, do calm down a bit once they've made some sort of mark on the world, which often weirdly ends up having a slightly detrimental effect on what they subsequently create, because they think, well, I've done it, I've made my point, I can carry on reiterating that.
I disagree. There's a tenderness, just to carry on from what Laura was saying, that, you know, there's a tenderness on this record, this kind of like willingness to be a bit more vulnerable with emotion and not kind of worrying what other people, and not being hungry with that, I think. I think that's what I get from this record, this kind of intimacy, this tenderness, this kind of gauzy, lovely sort of downiness in all of the music, rather than being like up front, since, yeah, I'm going to get you, strutting on the dance floor.
Speaking personally as well, you know, we were talking about the other, like how generic pop music has sounded at the moment and how a lot of it is in an image that she created like 10 years ago. Speaking personally and selfishly, you know, she is 10 years older than me, but the idea of pop music as a vehicle for like grown-up, thoughtful, sad experiences is very appealing to me. You know, I loved dancing on my own 10 years ago when I was a student in like a grotty nightclub in Bristol, but I'm really pleased that she's making this kind of music now, because pop traditionally hasn't really been allowed to grow up. And you know, the fact that she's managed to do it from like age 16 now to age 39 is kind of miraculous. Not many people have done that.
It is weirdly unexplored territory. Obviously, rock and roll got used to the idea of being a middle-aged art form eventually, to an extent, but pop is still pretty unforgiving on that front.
Yeah, totally. You know, I remember very, very specifically about 20 years ago, the supplement of my dad's Sunday newspaper or whatever being like, Madonna at 40, is she too old to be a pop star? And at 9 years old, I was like, oh, are you not allowed to be a pop star after 40? Maybe you're not. And then when she turned 60 recently, people were a lot more respectful and kind of, you know, venerating of her age and everything that she's achieved. But that's a huge leap in 20 years. And so, you know, Robin thankfully isn't facing that same kind of like, who does she think she is, you know, 39 and a pop star. But like you say, yeah, she's still kind of at the kind of cutting edge of it, because not many people have done it.
Well, just a final thought on the Robin album before we move on to the other things of which it reminded you. And I'll ask you, Kate, is it an extension of what she was already doing, do you think, 8 years on? Or does it mark an entirely new beginning? Perhaps, as Laura was suggesting, expanding the idea of pop as, I don't want to use a phrase as pejorative as middle-aged, but there it is, as a middle-aged art form.
Yeah, I wouldn't call this middle-aged by any stretch. I think it's a really delicious continuation of her music that's gone before. It's just a little bit tender and a bit more sensual, a bit more refined. It's a bit more chill, basically. She's not crying on the dance floor anymore. She's sort of lonely on a beach with a, you know, mojito and a lone conga or something, conga drum. I think there's, you know, there's plenty to love for people that have loved her before. And I think she's probably going to get loads of new, I hope she's going to find lots of new fans with this sound also.
Well, the spectacle of alone on a beach with or without a conga drum does move us seamlessly along to the part of the show where we ask our guests what the topic of the day reminded them of. Kate, this did take you apparently to Ibiza, which I think I'm right in saying is where you, Laura, interviewed her, wasn't it?
That was where I did half of it. I had never been to Ibiza before, so, you know, a blessed first experience with Robin, but I did also throw up in an English pub, so, you know, both sides of the coin.
I've never been to Ibiza myself, but I'm given to understand that's pretty much compulsory, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. You basically nailed it. You did the traditional
and,
Ibiza experience. You got two
San
ends
Antonio.
Of the scale.
Yeah.
What was your impression of Ibiza apart from the sick?
Well, I loved Pikes. It was great. It was really thrilling to think, like, you know, this is where Freddie Mercury had his birthday party, and this is the pool where the Club Tropicana video was filmed. It was exactly the kind of, like, tiny, sweaty club that I liked. But then we were staying, for convenience reasons, in San Antonio, which is a hole that makes Newquay, which is near where I'm from, look like the Cotswolds. It was disgusting. But who am I to talk? Because I decorated it with six.
Excellent.
But Kate, what was it about this, that Robin's new record, that conjured up visions of Ibiza for you?
Okay, well, I mentioned her being alone on the beach with a conga drum, and there was two tracks.
That's a video concept right there waiting to happen.
Well, you know what? She can have that one for free. Robin, you can take that one. Yeah, there's two sort of central songs in the middle of the album called Between the Lines and Beach 2K20. Or is that how I say it? 2K, mm-hmm. Is that the millennium-style way of saying it? Okay, I got it right. That sort of conjured up this sort of very Balearic vision to me, the sort of vision of old school Ibiza before the sort of oligarchs moved in, you know, and everything went all EDM and San Antonio became the sort of sick bay it is today. The sort of old school Ibiza, which was very much about, was very, you know, old school hippie. The sound was a bit more of a softer mixture of, you know, house and indie and something else. And I sort of see it all in these kind of like very romantic pink colours. It's all very hazy. There's lots of pot smoke. Everyone's fabulous, but not wearing sort of thong bikinis, wearing floaty outfits perhaps. And that to me is a sort of vision of Ibiza, you know, before the sort of famous story of the four English blokes, including Paul Oakenfold, going over to Ibiza and discovering Alfredo in an alfresco disco and taking a pill and then bringing it all back to London, you know, and thus Acid House was born. So for me, that was really what those two tracks conjured up an image of. And also because I knew that she had come back into public view, if you like, at Pike's, which was this old school hotel that was very much part of that old school vision of Ibiza. That's really what it conjured up to me.
That is a radically different vision of Ibiza that the both of you have managed to come away from the island with. We have this gorgeous elegiac vision here conjured by Kate and Laura. What you recall is vomiting.
I mean,
in
I
English
got a bit
pub.
Of that as well.
Oh, like, okay. Well,
I interviewed Robin at the villa that she was staying in. It was like just incredibly beautiful, like raked Japanese gravel garden, like that kind of green brush that looks a bit velvety, and like this over the kind of cedar smell that you only otherwise ever smell in a sauna. It was quite something. Mm. The thing I think is really interesting, which I don't really know why, maybe you do, Kate, is the Scandinavian and Nordic countries have always had like a really strong affinity for Ibiza and the Balearic sound. There's a lot of like Norse disco, which I think has got a bit of a crossover. Out of Gothenburg in the 90s and early 2000s, there was groups like Studio who were really influenced by it, and now Robin. Is there a kernel behind all that?
I absolutely have no idea, because of course those Nordic countries are very cold and crisp, and Ibiza is very well, but I know what you mean, that sort of Lindstrom-y, Prince Thomas-y, cosmic disco sound, which works wonderfully by a pool with a cocktail in hand, as it does, I'm sure, you know, in some kind of glacier or something, or wherever they rave over there. But yeah, I don't know.
Laura, the thing that the Robin album put you in mind of was another recently released album, the new Nina Cherry.
Yeah, it's not so much that I think they sound the same, but you know, Robin and Nana Cherry are like old friends. They've collaborated before, I think, on some Nana tracks. I'm not sure if Nana's been on any Robin tracks. You know, there's quite an age difference between them. Robin's 39 and Nana is 54 or 55, I think.
54, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, in terms of older women making pop music, I thought there was a strong affinity between them. And yeah, just, you know, in the same way that you don't have like a consistent hardened viewpoint in the new Robin record, the thing I really liked about the new Nana one, which she did with Fortet, like with her last one, but the last one with Fortet was quite brittle and stark, and this one's a lot more warm and lush. It makes room for not knowing, for questioning, and for kind of like a fragmented, searching viewpoint. And I think at this point in time, you know, when rhetoric is so hardened, blah, 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 it's just really nice to hear people going, I don't really know what the answers are. These are all the different ways I feel. Sometimes they contradict each other. I found both of them really comforting listens for that reason.
I was a massive fan of Nana Cherry when that was an extremely easy thing to be, because everybody was. And then I didn't really lose touch with her as sort of... One of those things where you're just seeing one incredibly annoying live performance by an artist you like can radically sort of, or can just make their records weirdly unlistenable for quite a period after it. It was in London ages and ages ago, and weirdly she kept making reference throughout the show to how people were always saying you can't come to London and rock, which is a thing I don't think anybody has ever said, thought, uttered, written or communicated.
Well, I don't think you should let one live show put you off.
I realise this is more a reflection on me than her.
Yeah, maybe. I don't really have anything to add on that point. But I was thinking about something just now, which is that the Nena album was produced by Fortet. I love both those artists. And when you listen to that record, for me, it definitely sounds like a Fortet record with Nena Cherry's vocals and all of these other sort of elements, that just sort of free jazz elements that she brings to it. But it very much feels like this pairing of Fortet and Nena. And on the Robin album, again, there's certain tracks where you think, yes, that definitely sounds like Joe Mount from Metronomy. Yes, that definitely sounds like Kindness. To me, that artist, an artist who has a sort of very specific sound. And I just wonder about that. I wonder about this kind of, rather than sort of smooshing them together, they're sort of existing side by side more in a way.
I think one thing for Robin with this album is she said that the collaborative process was really important. And so, yeah, it definitely dips in and out of different people's vibes. Like the Beach 2K20 song that you mentioned is the only song on there with Mr. Top Hat. And they made that in Ibiza, taking all their equipment outside, drinking outside and kind of overlooking the island. But yeah, I love the way those different things pop up. Like Joe Mount's bass, especially on Ever Again, the last song, is so him and so good.
Well, just finally then, I guess to go back to where we came in, I think it's fairly clear that you're both big fans of the new Robin album. But just as a final thought from each of you, and I'll ask you first, Kate, how good is it, especially when measured against what she's done previously?
I think it's really excellent, and I think that 8 years has definitely paid off. You know, if it's going to take 8 years to make a 5-star album, which is all the sort of reviews that I've seen for it, so the early reviews so far are suggesting, you know, that everybody sort of unanimously, it's 5 stars all round, or it's A+ or whatever they do now. If that takes 8 years, then fabulous. More artists should take 8 years, go to Ibiza, you know, get the rack up the cocktail bar, bring out the synths and see what happens.
I can think of quite a few artists for whom I'd extend that to 80 years or possibly 800. But Laura, definitely way up there as far as her previous output is concerned.
Totally. I feel like all of her previous output, some of it intentionally, has always been quite episodic. Like, you know, Body Talk came out in these three distinct parts. We've had these quite fragmented EPs. It's felt almost like watching a television series with episodes in quite distinct styles. That's a terrible metaphor. But this, the new album, feels like her first kind of truly complete work, I think. Even though what we're saying, it has some different styles on it, it feels like it tells one story and it's one artistic statement. And I think that's a very kind of mature thing to be doing. It's mature pop music.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Honey by Robin is out now on Konnichiwa Records. Thanks to my guests today, Kate Hutchinson and Laura Snapes, and to my producers, Holly Fisher and Paige Reynolds. We're back at the same time next week. But for now, from me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening.